Well, hello, I'm Alec Hogg, and this is your Biz News Briefing. It's August the 12th, Tuesday, all day. In our program today, we've got a few experiential stories. I love hearing from people who are actually in it. And the first one comes from investigative journalist Peter Louis Myberg on the IDT, that organization that government uses to facilitate the creation of schools, clinics, courthouses, and yet it's a cesspit of corruption. Experiential advice number two from Dr. Peter Groenewald, who's the Minister of Prisons. And number three is the MEC for Public Works in KwaZulu-Natal, probably the most corrupt province of them all. His name is Martin Mayer, and he's got some insights into what his job has taught him. From the international scene, our boy from Escort, the man who runs the biggest gold mining operation in the world, Mark Bristow, on Barrick and how it wrote off $1 billion off its mine in Mali, but he's put a pretty good spin on it. And then who's fooling who? Donald Trump is wanting to get a 15% cut of any NVIDIA chips, the H20 semiconductors that are sold to China. And China says we don't actually want our companies to have them. My goodness, what an interesting program we've got for you today. But we kick off with going back to something that we saw recently, and that was the Sachsenwald Shebeen. You might recall this is Sachsenwald Drive, the three properties owned by the Guptas. It was once a portal of power. Jacob Zuma used to get bossed around there, and the Guptas held court. Well, it has finally been sold. The first auction didn't go so well. In only one of the properties, that which housed the servants, was sold, but now the whole complex is gone. 34.5 million rand, numbers 3, 5, and 7, Sachsenwald Drive, and the buyer apparently also bought the next door house, 7A, for 6.5 million rand. So it's 41 million rand in total that was spent for the palace of the Guptas in Sachsenwald, or better known as the Sachsenwald Shebeen. And I presume he's going to create an even bigger compound into the future. It'll be interesting to see. Watch this space. But let's move on to a story of the moment. It's very good when you're a journalist to see one of your kind who's actually become a bit of a national hero, but that's Peter Louis Myberg. He managed to set up a sting for the chief executive of the IDT. The IDT has got a budget of about 5.5 billion rand a year to go and build schools, to build clinics, community centers. So in other words, serving the poorest of the poor. Well, instead of doing that, they have been plundering it with gay abandon. Peter Louis Myberg has been all over the place for receiving 60,000 rand as a supposed bribe in cash, from the CEO and the spokesman of the IDT, and then playing the video of the situation so that we could see exactly what these guys were up to. It's a heck of a story. So I asked him, given all the work that he's done, and he's written a couple of bestsellers, and he's been involved in Gupta leaks and many of the other, this most recent Digital Vibes story, many of those other investigations. I asked him if he were called by this big workshop that we've got that Cyril Ramaphosa wants to put together and seems like nobody else wants to attend, the 700 million rand a national dialogue, if he was asked to advise people on how we tackle our number one problem in South Africa, which is crime, how he would suggest they should go about it.
I would firstly skip the talk shops, honestly. And I think that is a general sentiment out there at the moment is we don't need a 700 million dialogue, 700 million rand dialogue to fix what a lot of us view as evidently obvious in terms of fixing some of South Africa's most pressing problems. So the first would be, and this very clearly came out at the Zondo Commission, is to fix the space in which criminal offenses is investigated and prosecuted. So the entire criminal investigations judicial framework needs a radical redress. The NPA, and especially the NPA's unit tasked with going after high-level corruption, is in radical need of more funding and resources. So they are short-staffed. The Hawks's criminal/corruption busting units are also hollowed out because of those, you know, state capture Zuma years. And these are two entities that really, if they start doing proper, you know, arrests and then successful prosecutions, and it happens routinely, and it's not kind of an isolated thing, which is currently happening, then the deterring factor becomes all the more overwhelming, and should certainly put a chilling factor on the brazenness with which the corruption is currently happening. And that is something that does not require a national dialogue. I think it really is one of the key problems facing South Africa still after the Zondo Commission. And I think that's what's really been alarming to a lot of us, is the Zondo Commission was supposed to be this cathartic moment where we aired all the corruption and we're going to deal with it not quickly. And then now we're sitting 4 years after the conclusion and, you know, the recommendations. And not only are the existing or the previous state capture cases not really being prosecuted in large numbers, but many new corruption fiascos or scandals have emerged after that. So I'm always like, almost like in my timeline nowadays, cutting it up as state capture one and state capture two. If you look at the recent history of South Africa, we had the state capture version under Zuma with the Guptas and many other players. We shouldn't make the mistake of only saying it's just the Guptas. But then in steps President Ramaphosa in his supposed reform era. And then we still have things like Digital Vibes and Babita Deokaran and so many other issues that I can't name now. So we clearly haven't sufficiently addressed that malaise. And I think that's one of the key things. Cleaning up the state sector and its procurement environment, definitely. Appointing appropriate people who work in those procurement spaces. Ensuring that the lifestyle audits are routinely conducted. You know, these are things that can be done. And it's very manageable for an entity like the IDT to have an ongoing lifestyle audit process in place to ensure that its officials aren't on the take and bending the tenders in the direction of their connected cronies. So, yeah, definitely. In short, if I had somebody's ear on that level, let's pause this national dialogue. Let's not go ahead with it, and let's just implement some of the fixes that there seems to be such wide consensus on in terms of what we need now in South Africa to clean up the procurement spaces so that the corruption at that level can be stymied.
It's a super discussion, and well done to Peter Louis Myburgh, who works for the Daily Maverick, and the work that they've done has been quite exceptional in this and other regards as well. Two big points there. If you recall, when Ramaphosa was all around us, Cyril Ramaphosa was going around the world telling us that state capture costs South Africa R1 trillion. You wonder if the next president is going to say, state capture too under Ramaphosa cost another R1 trillion, or was it more? And the second point that he makes that kind of struck home to me was the lifestyle audit. Surely, if there's an urgency or a sense of urgency on dealing with crime, just introduce lifestyle audits across the board through the public sector. It's so easy. If a guy has a house that is way beyond his ability to service the bond thereof, then surely he got the money from somewhere else. And often these numbers are just ridiculous when you have a look at, say, for instance, the Deputy President, Paul Mashatile, and the mansions that he stays in. But keep at it, to Peter Louis Myburgh and others of his ilk. On to the next experiential story, and this one is with a cabinet member of the Ramaphosa government, Dr. Pieter Groenewald. Now, he is the former leader of the Freedom Front Plus. He's been in parliament since 1994. He's seen it all. And he's also a clear-thinking conservative. And his view is, now that he's seen what's going on in the prisons of South Africa, his title is the Minister of Correctional Services, but essentially that means prisons. And he's seen it up front, and he's got a practical insight into it. We need to reopen the conversation on corporal punishment, and he explains in this little clip exactly why, and the death penalty. Both of these interviews, by the way, are available right now on BizNews TV. You can watch the Peter Louis Myburg one and the interview with Dr. Pieter Groenewald. But let's get on to why Dr. Groenewald thinks that the death penalty should be a conversation we're all having.
Of course, that is always a controversial subject. And I know that there are studies say that it is no deterrent. Then you have also studies from universities all over the world that actually say that it is a deterrent when you have the death penalty. Now, you've asked me my experience. In 1994, before we had the death penalty, there were about a maximum of 4,000 lifers in our prisons. It has now risen to 18, almost 19,000. So I think that does say something. It is not scientifically from my side, but if I just look at these numbers, then I can start asking my question, whether that will not be a deterrent. I say it will be a deterrent. It's the same if you referred now to corporal punishment, and that was exactly my argument. If people know what is happening in those overcrowding cells, you don't want to know, because you have some people saying, but it is inhumane to have corporal punishment. It's degrading for the person receiving it. The fact of the matter is, if you're in those cells and you get raped, I think it's even worse. And you're not going to be raped only once. It's going to happen many times. So that's why I said we must start that discussion again. And maybe also on the death penalty. We have people, when I said we must discuss or start the discussion on corporal punishment, some of the members of parliament then also said we must also start the discussion on bringing back the death penalty. Of course, if you do that, we must remember that it is seen as unconstitutional. There will have to be certain amendments. So I see that it will be a long road. But we must be honest towards each other and say, well, how can we solve problems? Of course, I do believe in human rights. But when you commit a crime, you must understand that you violated some other people's, basic human rights. And all over the world, and I've attended this year the United Nations anniversary of the Nelson Mandela rules, the minimum rules that must apply to prisons and all the member states. And all of them agree that you must have the balance to protect the victims of crime. And then, if you committed a crime, you cannot come forward and say, but I want full protection in terms of human rights. Of course, you must be treated with dignity, but there are rules. You have to pay the price, and that's my view. So I was quite surprised about the reaction from the corporal punishment side, and I will see how to deal with it further on. But it is a long road. It is not going to be a quick fix. And I say that is puzzle of a bigger puzzle. It's a small piece of a puzzle. So it's the same with if we have a debate on the death penalty. It is going to be a small piece of the bigger puzzle. But we have to look at all these things because, as I said, if you look at the numbers, then surely when death penalty has been prohibited, there is this spike, and I call it a spike, called in 30 years up to about 19,000 lifers. And as you said, it's heinous crimes they have committed. Those people are very dangerous people to society.
Just dwell a moment on that. So the death penalty was abolished in 1994. Up to that point, there were 4,000 people in our jails who were given life imprisonment. And primarily these are murderers or others who've done similar type of violent crimes. Today there are 19,000 people, and there's no deterrent by the death penalty. And that's the point that Dr. Groenewald is making. I guess it's just reminding us once again that we need to see the world as it is, not as we want it to be. And that is a problem that many idealistic politicians come onto the stage with, that they try to see the world as they want it to be and then make the rules for the rest of us according to their opinions.
And Hermanus is a man from this windy little town called Yaku. Sorry, other way around. Yaku's from Hermanus. Yaku, we need to talk about your upgrade problem.
I don't have an upgrade problem.
Two Audis, an Opel, a Kia, and a Hyundai. It's five cars, Yaku. Denial.
I just love cars. And we buy cars that make it so much easier for you and convenient to sell your car. You want to try it?
Okay, just once. Turn off the cameras. I see how this is addictive. Take two of those. We buy cars. The easiest way to sell your car by far.
Right now, you can get the cheapest Forex rate around, right here, on Shift. Pay less for your dollars, pounds, and euros here, and get to shop more here, and do more here, and enjoy more ooh-la-la here. Shift also lets you trade and transfer currencies, and buy shares in the world's best companies. It all happens right here, on Shift. You won't find a cheaper Forex rate anywhere else, no matter where you bank. Download the Shift app today.
Rita's Bench on the Hermanus seaside has become quite famous thanks to that We Buy Cars advert. Well, on to something with a little bit more upliftment, and that's Martin Meyer. He's the MEC for Public Works in KwaZulu-Natal. In other words, he's in the provincial government and his responsibility is for public works. He's been making progress, quite a lot of it, in what is probably the most corrupt province in South Africa. He spoke today, earlier this morning, to my colleague Chris Stain.
So one of the things that I focus on when I came into office is that I asked for all the forensic reports that was done by the Premier's office into the department. And I was shocked that after 20 forensic reports going back, some of them 5, 6, 7 years, not one of them were actually implemented. So none of the recommendations in the report were implemented. So I took an executive decision that those reports need to be implemented. We took that stance. Some disciplinaries against some officials were done. Some of the recommendations were done. Like, we now record all our bid committee meetings audiovisually through AI technology, which was a recommendation in the report. So we have really now moved forward. We also took a tough stance against officials. Currently, our HOD is going through his disciplinary, and four other senior officials were successfully prosecuted within the department and their services with us terminated. And then another big step that we took is we invited various MPOs that work in the field of corruption, like ALTA, like Corruption Watch, and other MPOs to a meeting. We played open cards. We put all our things on the table with them and said, this is what we're doing currently, but how can you advise us? What should we do differently? And currently working very closely with those organizations to strengthen our whistleblowing, but also strengthen our internal measures to prevent and curb corruption in the department. And we're really on the right track right now.
And what cost-cutting measures have you been able to implement?
I started in my office. Previously, two budget speeches back, it cost the department 300,000 rand to present the budget. We cut back that back. Last year, it was 300 rand. This year, we cut it back to 0 rand. We didn't spend any money on a budget because we do everything in-house, no glossy things, anything like that. The other thing we then did departmentally-wise is we looked at the use of cell phones, and we realized there were officials that had two or three cell phones from the department that we're paying for. We had over 50 former officials that still had cell phones. They don't even work for the department anymore, and they still had cell phones from the department. And some officials were just misusing it. So we've totally changed the way we do cell phones. We now just give an amount to the officials. They can pick their own cell phones from the preferred list, but they can't go over the amount because we now stuck to amount. And we've already saved millions just doing that very simple thing of taking control of the devices we give. Also within the ministry office, in the 6 months before I took office of last year, it cost over 3 million rand to run this ministry and the office that I hold here. In the second 6 months, only 200,000 rand because we just said we can't just take seven officials to travel with me all the time, travel all over the province using mini vehicles and all those type of things. So that's the other thing that we have done. Through digitalization as well, we'll be saving over 6 million rand in printing costs for the department. So there's a lot of measures, and it looks like small things, but they all do add up in the end of the day. And then another big thing is that we are really moving away from consultants. We actually do have the expertise within the department. So I was unsure, why do we keep using very expensive consultants if we are able to deliver those services ourselves with the engineers, architects, and all of that we have? Very recently, we opened a school called the Faith Mashlabe School that we didn't use any consultants, and that cost us all, saved us almost 8 million rand just on that one project.
At Sun Exchange, we make going solar simple, profitable, and completely risk-free. Join over 100 satisfied South African customers already enjoying the benefits of risk-free solar. Start saving today. Visit sunexchange.com and join the solar revolution.
Well, yesterday and this morning, the international media were full of the news that Donald Trump had managed to pull off another deal, this time with the providers of high-quality semiconductors, NVIDIA and ARM, so that whenever they sell any of their products into China, well, certainly of the high-quality range, then 15% of the proceeds has to go to the American government. The Chinese government, however, is not very happy about this, not just because it feels that it'll be funding, or its companies will be funding Donald Trump's regime, but because it says that the H20 semiconductor is not top quality and they should not be using it in the first place. Here's our partners at Bloomberg.
We're getting redhead lines crossing right now across the Bloomberg. This is a Bloomberg scoop that at the same time, or at least shortly after what we heard from President Trump, China has in fact been urging its own companies not to use NVIDIA's H20 chips in new guidance. This again is according to Bloomberg reporting. I've got more details on this. So China has put out notices to a number of state-owned and private companies urging them to avoid using these H20 processors. These were the ones, of course, initially banned by the President Trump and his administration before, again, we got the news yesterday that NVIDIA could start selling them into the Chinese market if they give 15% of those revenue revenues to the U.S. Treasury. Over the past few weeks, according to Bloomberg reporting, Chinese authorities have sent notices to a range of firms discouraging the use of less advanced semiconductors. This, again, according to people familiar with the matter. Min, this is a response from China. It firms up what we expected, what had been signaled from state media and state media affiliated blogs yesterday, suggesting that China has concerns about national security risks that they claim are associated with some of these chips. They have suggested there are backdoors, for example, in some of these NVIDIA chips. Certainly that has been a concern that's been flagged. And now we have confirmation that China has been sending out official notices. How significant is this?
Yeah, definitely very significant. The timing as well, very significant, coming on the day when President Trump had announced the extension of the trade truce. And we know China had been pushing so hard for the rolling back of these tech curbs. And clearly, China doesn't see the reversal of the decision to sell H20 chips to China as a win or a concession at all. And this comes as U.S. officials have been publicly calling for the installation of these location tracking capabilities in the chips that are being sold to China. You add to that, H20 isn't even the most advanced chips that the U.S. has. And so China had repeatedly, through its state media, signaled that it's opposed to these sort of backdoor to the U.S. government, and also saying that the H20 chips are not the most efficient chips out there. It remains to be seen whether or not the sale of the Blackwell line of products, because it's more advanced, whether that is enough to appease Beijing to put aside some of these security concerns. Because, of course, on the U.S. side, President Trump has shown a willingness to put aside national security concerns for a price if NVIDIA pays them, you know, 15% of the China sales revenue they had been open to sell those, to issue those export licenses for the H20 chips. Now, of course, the big question is, you know, is chips still at the center of this trade tussle between the two sides? Will China still want any of the chips that U.S. can offer if the security concerns are not addressed? That's a big question. And of course, China will likely continue to pour in more resources to double down on its self-reliance and self-sufficiency push.
So here's the craziness of it. Those chips are made in Taiwan. Taiwan then sells the chips to TSMC, the company, to NVIDIA. NVIDIA then upgrades it to a level that is required if you want to do sophisticated things. It's got a new chip. There's the H20. Now they're talking about the Blackwell chip, which is the next generation. And that then goes into mainland China. So we in South Africa have just irritated everybody by telling Taiwan we don't recognize you. And so Taiwan has said, well, we won't be sending you our semiconductors in future. We won't even get into the game. We won't even be in the game. Whereas they are fighting here about the more sophisticated level of the game. The Chinese, of course, are hoping that at some point in time they'll be able to produce their own semiconductors, but that's not the case at the moment. We close off with another local boy made good in the global market, Mark Bristow. You won't hear his name as often as Elon Musk, but Mark's he's a big deal in the global scene. He runs the biggest gold miner in the world called Barrick. Barrick has a massive gold mine in Mali. Mali, however, has got a new government after a military coup, and the new government went into the mine and decided that they would take the gold away from Barrick. This is a problem for Barrick, of course, and as far as its investors are concerned. But good old Bristow is putting a spin on it, as you'll hear in this conversation that he had this morning with our partners at Bloomberg.
Certainly a surprise, that $1 billion charge. You can see that reflected in the shares. What can you tell us about the status and the prospects of that specific mine?
It's just an accounting adjustment. It's got nothing really to do about anything. The mine is no longer accounted as a consolidated component of our portfolio, and we were had to change the way we account for it, and so it moved from operations to an investment. Doesn't reflect anything on the underlying value or the process that we are busy with to be able to deliver a solution for that operation. On the counter, Katie, the the results were in line, and we increased dividends by 50%. We bought back more shares, well on track with our $1 billion share buyback program. Production was up and costs were down. All good for a gold miner, and certainly at these gold prices.
Definitely, with gold prices pushing to record highs. Mark, I think one of the questions, though, is yourself and Barrick have this very strong reputation of being able to run mines in challenging countries, let's say. So how do you ensure investors that you continue to be able to do so as the events unfold in Mali?
I think that's a very good question, and sure, we have a good reputation and have continued to be able to find solutions, work together with our host countries, and to ensure that we split the economic benefits fairly between the host country and our business. Mali is quite uniquely different in that it's a junta that overthrew a civilian government and wanted to try and push a new mining code. In fact, a new mining code that didn't even align with the mining code that they had approved. And when you invest in these sort of countries, you expect the sovereign agreements that we undertake and enter into over time to be respected. And we have dispute mechanisms embedded in our agreements, and we invoke those dispute mechanisms as we have done in Mali, just like one would do in any normal country. At the same time, it's important to open the channels of communication, which we have done and we continue to do. And ultimately, I'm pretty sure we'll come to a solution with respect to this challenge.
I keep saying it, Mark. Hopefully you do get it right in the end. Bristow made his name. He's from Escort. He's a geologist. He made his name at Rand Gold Resources. And for those of you who are interested in some ancient history, that was part of Rand Gold, which was part of the Keble organization. Bristow and Keble weren't great friends. And so the businesses that existed in that group in the rest of Africa, outside of South Africa, were put into a company called Rand Gold Resources. Bristow was so successful in that eventually Rand Gold Resources was far, far bigger than the original parent company. And his successes were noted. And now he runs the biggest gold miner in the world. And if anybody can fix this or untie this Gordian knot, it's Mark from Escort. Well, this has been your BizNews briefing for today. Until tomorrow, when Bronwyn will be back again. Cheerio.